This is a FUBAR Radio podcast. Go to FUBARradio.com for more details. Screen Talk with Dan Clark on FUBAR Radio.
Hello and welcome to Screen Talk. I'm Dan Clark. Today we are not going to be doing any news or reviews. This is for a good reason. It's because our guest is such a brilliant, interesting guest today. We've got so much to cover with such a huge body of work. So we're just going to crack on. With me in the studio is Mr. Rhys Shearsmith.
Rhys Sun.
Looking me up. Yes, I've been looking you up, and I'm really impressed by that name.
Son of Rhys, because my daddy's called Rhys, and Reeson is literally son of Rhys. That's my real name.
Do you know, Reeson Shearsmith kind of made me think of like a 1940s RAF pilot or something.
Yeah.
There's something. Shearsmith. What made you change it to Rhys?
Well,
because of conversations like this.
Yes, it's just the shortened version of yeah. it, I think. And Reeson's a bit weird. I think it's a bit too much of a mouthful. But it's hard to say Rhys Shearsmith. You have to sort of stop in the middle.
Yeah, they're difficult.
So that's always bugged. It's followed me everywhere, that. But it would, wouldn't it? It's my name.
So your first song, we're going to kickstart. Before we get into an interview, we're going to kickstart with your first choice of two songs from movies.
Yeah.
This is the rather eerie, unsettling Bucket of Blood from the soundtrack Carrie. We'll play this and then you can explain exactly why you chose this.
Excellent.
I would say that last bit there is the weirdest, creepiest part of it all.
Well, that's just the bit where Carrie is, unfortunately, covered in blood, by the pig's blood.
Do you not think that that has a lot of similarities to Hitchcock's Psycho?
Well, it's there's a lot of strings, which I would suspect. It's a little bit Bernard Herrmann. But I don't know why I picked that particular bit. It's always stayed with me. I love Carrie as a 70s film. It's got a tone about it that in the same way that E.T. captures a certain light that I sort of close my eyes and think I remember that light from a kid. Carrie has the same feel to me, and it's a particular feel of that time. It really transports me back.
All of those early Spielberg have that.
They do
that
thing.
And I think De Palma had about three films that all had a similar. You're probably saying something that would really excite and please a DOP somewhere in the world.
I hope so. Yes, because that's exactly what he's trying to do. Yeah. I guess, isn't it? Yeah.
God, if you've done that in 30, 40 years' time, people are going, I still can remember the light.
Yeah, I feel like I know that light.
You've really done your job there. So, Reese, this is going to sound a bit like This Is Your Life, which I don't. This isn't my intention because you are here, and it's weird that I just list your curriculum vitae.
Of course,
but I have to because that's what they do in interviews.
I know. Yeah,
you
apparently.
Know? Do you find that embarrassing when people do that in front of you?
Depends what ones you're going to read out. I try to omit the bad ones.
I'm only going to do the bad ones. Is that okay?
That's fine, yeah.
So you, of course, you are an acclaimed actor of screen and television and stage.
Yes,
you are one half of the team behind Psychoville and Inside Number 9, and one quarter, is that technique?
That's correct, I guess. Yeah,
of the hugely popular League of Gentlemen, which began, as we just mentioned, off air 17 years ago.
Yeah,
and when did you actually start the group?
We started the first League of Gentlemen show, I think, was in Brighton in about 1995, in the Commedia. That was
really?
Our first show,
How come in Brighton?
I don't know. We'd done some shows at the... Well, yes, no, it was Canal Cafe was where we began. Yeah. In Maida Vale, we started doing little shows. But our sort of first thing where we thought we're doing a show and it's our foray into people that didn't know us coming to see it was Brighton. And it was, nearly 20 years ago. It's quite horrific.
It's terrifying. Yeah. I remember seeing it. In fact, I was in a sketch group and we were on... We were on the same stage after you at the Canal Cafe in like 96, I think it was.
Right, yeah.
And
that was the year that we went to Edinburgh.
Yeah.
Yeah, first time.
And I remember everyone going, oh, you've got to see the League of Gentlemen. You've got to see. So we came to see you, and I couldn't believe how fully formed it was. So, I mean, maybe that whole year had been the year where you'd sort of try different things, but it felt like you guys knew exactly what it was you were doing from almost the offset. Is that a fair thing to say?
I think it just evolved in the way that we'd kept doing it on stage and trying out new characters, and then if something seemed to hit or we thought it had legs, we would pursue it almost like a sketch. The character would return, and you were sort of rewarded if you came back with a sort of evolution of that character. It was sort of the TV series in embryo, really, doing it on stage.
I seem to remember people saying, "Oh, you've got to go back each week because they continue the story every Monday." Was it an every Monday or
we
Wednesday?
All
or something?
All these Mondays, at Canal Cafe, because we needed the theatricality of sitting down and watching it like a bit of theatre. You know, we were very rigorous with the staging of it because we'd seen sketch shows that were just tinkly piano between each sketch, and we just thought that slightly lets it down. If it felt like a big complete thing, we just tried to be a bit more it wasn't rocket science, but we just wanted it to be completely slick, even in the moving of the chairs. And I think that bought us a lot of they made people sit up because it was a little bit more thought about.
Yeah.
I mean, not massively, but it just helped with the seamlessness of one thing into the next.
Well, you directed.
No, we sort of did it ourselves.
Did it yourselves?
Yeah, we did it ourselves.
And how come you always did credit Jeremy as being the fourth member rather than what people, writers who are not performers, normally get treated quite badly and sort of forgotten about? But you were always mentioned as a four-piece. And you see the photo and you go, who's this mystery fourth guy?
Yeah, he gets, it's Jeremy's 50th birthday today.
Oh, happy birthday.
Yeah,
I'm not sure when this is going out, birthday for them.
Yeah, in this then day. Jeremy was always completely part of it, and it felt odd to exclude him in any part of the process.
Yeah.
He just didn't want to act, and yet he was absolutely part of the voice of what we sort of were doing. So we just...
I thought it was very generous of you.
Well, that's
to
very
do
kind.
That.
It never occurred to us that we were being kind.
Just thought you had to do it.
Yeah.
Is there a difference to the way you and Steve, work now compared to when there were four of you?
Yeah, I think so. I think we are freer. I mean, it's just easier because there's only two voices, you know. Before, it was always harder to... The difficulty with the League was always bringing all the stuff to the table and then thinking, right, how do we make it all fit into Royston Vasey? I mean, our conceit was, can it not just be a sketch show? Can there be something that makes it a whole? And the trick was to just make it as if they were all part of this town. And that just gave it something that was bigger than the the sum of its parts. But we write now with... It was easier writing Psychoville because that was very much a narrative, and we thought, and we didn't really have to be beholden to Mark and Steve at the meeting where we'd bring our things. So it will be hard to go back to four voices in the room.
Yeah.
But it was suddenly felt a little bit easier because we were a little bit more in control of the material and where we wanted to take it.
So were you a bit like Python where you had the two sets of teams?
Completely, yeah.
Really?
Me and Steve used to write together, and Jeremy and Mark would write together. And oftentimes, because of that dynamic with Mark and Jeremy, Mark would do a lot of monologues because Jeremy wouldn't be the other voice in the double act.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So Steve and I did a lot of twos because we were just writing together. So that was how it sort of worked out like that. But then we would write, you know, Jeremy very specifically wrote Pop, which is this horrible landlord character that Steve does. For Steve, he said, "Will you write me a character?" Because we wanted to cross-pollinate a little bit.
Cross the streams.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. See what happened.
Yeah.
Wow, I never knew that. So, in a way, it was a natural extension when you guys...
When we started writing, yeah. Because we just wanted a break. It wasn't like we had a row. It was just like we sort of felt like we needed to rejuvenate a bit. Mm-hmm. And we just sort of stopped after the... When we'd done three series, a film, two live shows, it was like... Yeah. Christmas special, and we just thought, let's have a bit of a break. And we just thought, well, we were happy to carry on creating something ourselves, Steve and I, so we just carried on writing. We did Psychoville, which is a sort of kick against it being not sketches. You know, we thought we'd like to try and do a narrative that where you're expected to follow it. And that was our sort of answer to that.
So would you say if Mark and Jeremy did a show together, how different... to League of Gentlemen would that be, do you think?
That's a good question.
Because I'm wondering, like, whose influences are in... Because it's, I think, despite some of the slight different format, the difference in formats and things, there is still very much a link between Psychoville and Inside Number 9 or Number 9. What can we call it for short, so I don't have to say the whole... 9? Should we call it 9?
Call it 9,
There's still, you can see League of Gentlemen in it.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I wondered if those two did something, would it feel like Terry and June? Were you two the ones that were making it really like that, or...
I don't know. I think...
Or do you all just have really, really similar taste?
I think there is similar taste. I think if Mark and Jeremy did something specific, because that in itself is a particular pairing, it would... I think there'd be a darkness to it, but there'd be a... I think Mark had perhaps had more... I was going to say had more heart. He absolutely hasn't. He's got a heart of a black coal.
But it's still a heart.
Yeah, he's still a heart. It's a strangely shaped one. I don't know. I'm not sure what their
it would be one man roaming
It would just be
Martin
in a monologue, about being a mortician or something.
Yeah.
Probably.
I would have thought in a way that just the two of you is in some ways more difficult because if you would disagree on something, then there's no... democracy, because it's just two equal numbers.
Yes, it's harder, and it's more silence in the room.
Is there?
Yeah. Although, I think we've got better at just getting on with it. We're much... Maybe it's out of confidence, or just...
We're all pros, lazy. Come on.
Maybe we're pros, I don't know what it is, but we enjoy it more. So it was a torturous process, I remember writing Psycho. It took too long. We spent too long on it. Months and months.
Was it hard? I mean, writing's hard anyway,
writing
right?
Writing is hard, yeah, I guess it is. It's like pulling teeth. But I think we were just really hung up on the structure of it and all those all those strands and trying to make all of them work and feel satisfying and deliver. And we just felt like we thought we knew what it would be and we were just trying to push it. You know, wanted to feel like it was a 24 of comedy where you couldn't wait for the next one and have these amazing cliffhangers where you think, what? And you're not ahead of it at all and it's surprising. You know, all television is... slightly flagged up now just because you can't not read about it or they have to give you it all on a play. And which is what we suffer from continually with things like Psychoville, where the only enjoyment is going in blind.
Yeah.
When you don't know anything, it's exciting to see it unfold and you trying to work out what happens. And particularly as increasingly we've done these sort of surprise endings. I mean, it's become a millstone around our neck now because people only are interested in the last 20 seconds where it gives them this massive kick of a twist. So if that's all it's about, I mean, it's not. It's the 28 minutes of getting there that it's about. But
you've become the M. Night Shyamalan's television.
A terrible mantle. But if we can avoid that and remain surprising to ourselves. I mean, of course, the trouble now is we've done so many of them that in itself is that it's like a game of where you're trying to second guess. Shall we do the twist? that they think we're going to do or the one that they think we might do, but then we should do that one. Then sometimes we get there and we think they'll be onto us by now, so we go, but we revert back to what we originally thought they would think, but they'll think that we won't do that because that's too obvious, but then we will do the obvious.
It sounds like
mad.
Mental torture. I mean,
it's
you sound
hellish.
Like a mentally ill person.
I know.
No disrespect to mentally ill people, but you,
this is what I spend my days doing. You know, you people that watch it, you watch it, it goes away for a year. I think about it from the moment that you've stopped watching it and forgotten about it. So when it comes back on in a year and a half's time,
well, the worst,
that is why I'm mad.
The worst thing when you're in the absolute kind of pit of the madness when you're writing is when you go to bed that night and you're lying there thinking about all the things, or when filming's coming soon and you're thinking about how all the scripts are going to go on TV. When you're trying to second guess or third guess or triple, you know, quadruple guess someone. How does that manifest when you're lying in bed at night, and has it caused problems at home?
Well, I am often awake and have to jump up and write something down and think I'll forget that.
Yeah.
And
that's the worst, isn't it?
Yeah.
Have you ever made the mistake of going, no, I'll remember it in the morning?
Yes, I have. And it's gone. You think, I will never not remember that. Yeah,
it's too good.
Oh my God, what was that brilliant thing?
It's so painful.
It happens a lot, so you must write it all down, these thoughts.
When you were doing Psychoville, was there at all a deliberate intention to do something different to what you'd done before? Or
it felt like, how could you do anything that's not like The League of Gentlemen, and or anything that, if it's anywhere near it but not as good. We were just so petrified of spoiling it, you know. Mm-hmm. We're very proud of what we've done, and what do you do? You say it's that terrible second album thing where you think, can we top it? People expect a certain thing of us, and they want it, but they don't want it. You know, it's all that terrible thing where you're sort of aware as a fan of what it is to have something spoiled, and we were so aware of that feeling of just wanting to get to do it right. And all in the end, you've got to let go of all of it and just think what. In the room with Steve and I, just sat laughing. If something made us laugh, it would be in. That would be our rule in the end. And you can't start to worry about what you think people want, because you will never cater for everyone. So you've just got to do your own thing. And I think we are quite undiluted in what we end up doing. We're left alone by the BBC and never really interfere with our scripts. So it's incredible.
By the way, it is amazing.
Yeah.
Because I can't imagine an unknown group now, in this current climate, getting shows like the ones you make commissioned. Yeah. It has to have some kind of brand behind it, which
of
is
course.
You guys.
Yeah,
I mean, some of the stuff that you've done, I just can imagine the channel going, what? Are
I
you
know.
Sure?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
But they don't, no?
No.
Really?
No interference at all. John Plowman is our brilliant producer, and he's been our champion in the room with these meetings, where I think probably sometimes it's all they've gone now. Actually, now it's gone. Mm. It's gone away. We can't do this anymore. And he's
maybe
gone,
there's like fights in boardrooms that you don't know about.
We are shielded from it, and it just appears that we sit and we write it, and then we present them. They're all done. Sort of, they don't say you should do one in a joke shop, or they don't tell us anything. We just write them and go, that's the new series. What do you think? And then we get the odd little note. Nothing really spectacular. Sometimes we smile and deliver them again on different coloured paper as if we've made the amendments.
I like that trick. Yeah.
and then that's it. And it's sort of, and I think that is why it's a very singular thing, and it has a voice, a very rare thing these days, I think. That you might not like it, but you sort of can't argue with it, because it's our thing, and it's not a plateaued, panel beaten thing where it doesn't really cater for anyone anymore, because you can see far too many fingers trying to massage it into pleasing everyone, and of course it
pleases. Have you ever tried doing stuff in America?
No,
because I can't imagine.
We never have. We should try it. Or if there'd be any interest, but I think we've had the odd foray into, or they're looking into maybe doing a version of.
Well, I'm sure
that.
Now that there's Amazon and Netflix and all those things, I can totally see you guys doing stuff there, but in the sort of when it was just the four networks out there, I could imagine executives going, we can't inflict this on our children of America.
I know, I guess so. I mean, you talk like it's really dark and horrible.
But it isn't really.
But it's not really, is it? That's the trick we've pulled. I think a lot of Inside Number 9 certainly is very palatable. You know, some of it's Chuckle Brothers to me. But my version of Chocolate Brothers. But nevertheless,
I don't know which episodes you saw that I missed. pretty fucked
well,
up ones.
That one we did that was this kind of silent robbery. That was very. That was like a. We did one that was completely like Steve and I robbing a house, and we didn't speak. It was like an exercise in
that was
sort
very,
of slapstick.
Yeah,
and it was quite light. I mean, we did kill some dogs, and that we both got shot at the end. But and it was quite bloody.
Well, there are some people who think death and dogs being killed is equals dark, but whereas to us, that's just an hors d'oeuvre.
Yeah, absolutely.
Really mean. I loved the fact that you did an entire episode in one take, or so we believe.
Yeah, it was two takes. But
it was two takes.
Yeah.
Okay,
and it was only two because we this was in Psychoville, episode four. We did this experiment. It was born out of, can you do one that won't cost any money? Because they wanted another episode that was a bottleneck episode, which is where you try to do one very self-contained. All of number nine we thought would be cheap, but of course it's not, because each week you remount and you do a different world, and so weirdly it's expensive, because they're all different situations. But with Psychoville, they said if you do one, it's basically you and Steve in a room, like Doc Cotton in the laundrette, then... Which we did consider, but we didn't get it, couldn't get it.
They used to do that in EastEnders, as well, didn't they?
Just these special ones where it was like, oh, it's all about the acting this week.
Yeah.
And so we thought, well, let's do one with Maureen and David, which is these two kind of serial killing mother and son. And it was a homage to Hitchcock's Rope, which he did in 10-15 minute chunks, non-stop.
Because you probably you wouldn't have been able to do an entire...
We couldn't do a full half hour because the dolly arm needs to be repowered halfway through. So 22 minutes in, there's a seamless cut.
Right.
Where the camera cuts to the back of this box and there's a cut in that moment that's quite invisible. But it was only two takes. And it took, we had it two days to do it. And on about the 25th take, or the 18th take on the second day, we'd got the first 22 minutes perfect. And then we'd have to do the end a few times because it was very theatrical. I mean, it wasn't just us that had to be word perfect and not go wrong. It was all the dolly had to be, you know, as the camera moved in for close-ups, the stagehands had to come in and move the furniture out of the way and all that, and then slide it back in when it went out wide again.
And everyone
it was a big ballet of trying to have everyone in simpatico trying to get it all right, and it was great. It was very...
What if you got to, like, the 11-minute mark and fluffed a line? Was it just...
It's fucked. It's gone. Yeah. Just had to start again.
It did was you like, hate each other for
it? Yeah. Mark actually got Gatiss in for this one as a sort of homage to us three being back together again, and he went wrong on the last line of the last 10 minutes. He'd done it a few times.
This is why we don't work with you anymore, Mark.
Sort of no, anyway, you don't see him on TV anymore, do you? Nothing to do with the media anymore.
He's struggling a bit. Did you enjoy Birdman on the subject of films supposedly being one take?
I did, yes.
I was a big fan of it. I was surprised some people didn't like it.
Yeah, and there was a lot of people that, I mean, is it that thing of being told this is brilliant and therefore you bristle and think I'm not going to like it? Yeah, I think there was a bit of that going on with that film particularly, but I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I loved it, and some people I think felt it was a bit in, because it was all about anxiety around being famous and showbiz.
Yeah, and who cares about that, they think.
Yeah, well, we do.
But we tussle with the idea of doing in things a lot. We often think about... You know, we've done a lot of sort of, we did one in set in a dressing room and things. And I think in the end, as long as you feel like you can.
I remember that. Julia Davis was in.
Yeah, she was. She was the stage manager. Yeah. And I think it's all right if you can sort of get past it only being about that world. Because, you know, not everyone is a police or surgeons. And yet, all these people are able to.
Everyone's an EastEnder.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. You can watch things and not sling your arm across your eyes and say, I don't understand it. And I hate the fact I'm being. Given a world I'm not party to, because all drama is that, isn't it? It's a dip into that world. But so I think we sometimes shy away from wanting to do it more. I love doing Legs Akimbo Theatre lately. And I do a whole series of them touring around schools, but I get told it might be a bit too in. Just do actuary things, but I love it. I love doing those kind of things.
That slightly annoys me, because I think forgetting what you're kind of saying or what it's about... If it's a funny character in funny situations, surely that's the connecting bit.
Absolutely, yeah, that's the bit. And of course, it's forgiven for whatever it is then, isn't it? As long as it's
I think everyone knows theatre in education, don't they?
Of course they do, that's what's fun.
We all saw it.
We've all had one.
Have you ever had the urge, desire, inclination to do a, let's say, a traditional sitcom? With Steve or yeah. with the guys?
Well, that's funny. We have tried to do it, yeah.
Have
we,
you?
A little bit. We were asked by the BBC, could you do one that's just like not dark and it's a BBC? We have never really... We sort of wrote something that was a little bit like an episode of Inside Number 9, which is called About This Grandma's Party.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the closest to like a mundane... It was just a family, you know, yeah. It felt like that. I think they thought, well, they can do it. This is sort of...
Yeah,
the world.
It. Yeah.
And but it sort of it was the wrong sort of way around to think about using that as a springboard into a situation, because it was only good because you were able to do these huge peaks mm-hmm. of drama and people were dying and things, and that was what was sort of satisfying about it as a half hour. With the resetting of a sitcom, it's quite, I think it quickly used itself up as an idea. So we would like to experiment in doing it. I think it might be within us, but we always find that it feels lacking in depth if it's just the surface comedy.
Yeah.
If it doesn't kind of almost make you cry or make your heart stop or everything is turned on its head from what you thought it was at the start. We feel like we haven't quite delivered anything that's worthy enough.
Nothing to do with you guys are obviously heavily influenced by horror and cult movies and things. Yeah. So it isn't that puts you off the idea. It's just like, how do we tap into the sort of the darker or the emotion?
Because we've delivered some Inside Number 9 scripts where we thought, right, well, let's just do a funny one. Yeah. Imagine that. Coming out of the BBC comedy department. Let's just try to do a funny one. And they've even said, well, it's all right, but could they all burn to death? Or they've even felt it was lacking, because it's a version of us without the thing that we do.
Yeah.
I feel it. It really. You feel it with our things.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel that we don't. It's absolutely missing something that it just doesn't catch fire, so to speak, until that element is put in. When we did the Sardines episode of Inside Number 9, which was this game of sardines, and we thought it would be funny to have just people joining as the half hour went by until there was 12 people in the wardrobe. That was originally written, and it was just that was the conceit, and it was quite funny and the characters were quite humorous, and it was just this game, and that was sort of all it was, and it never really, and it was fine, but then we went back in and we peppered in very lightly the child abuse. And suddenly, it gave it all so much more dread and weight and drama.
Yeah.
And then it was like, oh, this is an Inside Number 9. This is what we do now.
Yeah.
And that
child abuse.
Yeah.
Inside Number 9.
That was the key ingredient. But it was very lightly done. It was barely there,
yeah.
And it wasn't there. And then we added it in with looks almost, and a thing at the end, and with Tim Key. And suddenly, it was like, yeah, that's now satisfying in a way it wasn't before.
Yeah.
Before, it was fine. It was like a light comedy. Bit of an Aitbourne-y feel to it, and now it's become so much deeper and more worthy. I mean, in the way that some drama makes you feel. I mean, I think that is such a maligned thing, comedy, because it does so many things, you know.
Well, I was going to say, do you think of Inside Number 9 as a comedy?
Not anymore.
Because I saw, and I don't mean that in a...
Yeah,
in
no,
any,
no, absolutely, yeah. No, I think we strive for it to be more than just a comedy.
Yeah, right, and I remember watching... the Sheridan Smith one. Yeah. I can't remember the title of the episode.
12 Days of Christie.
And it, to me, that was like an out-and-out drama.
Yeah, I mean,
that
it was really, yeah.
We
did toy with the idea of trying to put more gags in, because we knew it was just, it was heartbreaking. And but in the end, we just thought, no, that's the story we're telling. And I think in this format, where you could tell that it's done it play for today's, some could be funnier than others, and this one is suited to this, just telling this story. And I think we've dared to start to think, maybe arrogantly, and not... fulfilling the brief anymore, but we just thought, well, if it hooks you in and you're there till the end and you're riveted and it does something to you other than that wasn't funny, then it's allowed. And I think I think they're good enough, hopefully, stories to keep you hooked and satisfy, even if they're not making it not just gag, gag, gag mm-hmm. all the way through. Because we're not always about that at all.
Yeah, and I would say from the start you were always about telling stories and characters, they were just as important as jokes. Or
absolutely,
just being funny.
And we've got more, increasingly our writing has gone much more narrative, I think.
Do you, knowing that you make a kind of comedy that A, isn't being made as much anymore and can challenge the question of what is comedy, do you get hurt by any kind of negative feedback on stuff, even though you know your stuff probably might provoke it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. I can see why people. Oh, yeah. I get. I'm irate. any criticism at all. Yeah.
Criticism. Like, Vincent Price. Isn't it?
I would absolutely, if I could, strap anybody down that had anything to say about in a negative way. And it's all right. Give me. You've said this in your thing, so you didn't like it, and it wasn't funny for these. But give me three examples, or I will pour this petrol on you and set you on fire. You know, that is, and that reasonable.
Even in this day and age, like on Twitter, because
that's the worst thing in the world. Yeah. Of course, you can't. I've torn myself up reading things on forums and things, and you just think you can't because it's.
I've actually.
Who are these people? You know.
Yeah, I found it helped me with criticism. Because there's such a huge volume now, but in such small amounts because of literally the amount you can type on things like Twitter, that it sort of washes over me a bit.
I suppose it's got to, hasn't it?
It was the old days when a printed review meant everything and you knew all the rest of the industry were reading it. You'd just be at home going, what are they all thinking?
Oh, no, yeah.
And actually, terrible. People weren't thinking that.
That's the terrible thing, isn't it? Yeah, it's just like... three people in a chat room or something. You think, well, no one. I've fueled it more than the reality of, and they probably think no one will ever read it.
Yeah,
that's the other thing, isn't it? They hear about these trolls that just think, I just said it. I didn't think you'd read it. And it's like someone's turned up at the house and
I know, right?
Half
I didn't
mad
think
with it. Yeah.
Oh, so you is there anything in the because you're writing the new series, right?
We've written the new series and it's we've just done the third series and it's going out in the autumn, I believe.
And when you do write together, do you do office hours?
Yeah, very much. Yes. Yeah, we've got a little room in Muswell Hill where we live equidistant from it. I think if it wasn't so near, we wouldn't do it. We couldn't be bothered to do it. But we literally can turn up. Our children go to the same school, and we do it absolutely like 9 till 5:30, sometimes 6 if we're having a good day. Sometimes forget it at 2.
And how many minutes past 9 are you actually typing new words?
No, 10 o'clock.
Okay. That's not bad, though.
Yeah, sometimes.
It's pretty good.
Sometimes half 10 if there's things to talk about. But generally, yeah, we do try to do a full day.
I find writing on... So I used to write with other people, and it was more fun and in some ways more creative, but you could spend 2 hours arguing about a character's name.
Yeah.
Which could change later, you know.
I know, absolutely. Yeah. We have to eventually stop those things. We're like, all right, look, let's just put Madge. And it's a placeholder, but yeah, we'll come back to it. Yeah.
And then you never do.
You never do, and it's left, and you see it, and Madge, and we're always going to change that.
Yeah. It goes out, it's like, you know, and you're like, shit, this is letting it down.
That was not meant to be in.
Is there stuff in the upcoming series that where you feel like you've challenged this line between comedy and drama even further?
I think so, yes. Yeah. I think even for us, the third series of Number 9 is quite dark.
Is it?
Yeah. I think we were watching them. The fun part, of course, when we've done these 6, it's kind of the fun part, but it's the difficult part as well, is what order they go out in. Because we don't write them with specifics, knowing which will be the best and go out first. But you've got to start thinking about... BBC like it when if we have one that's sort of accessible for... most people to start to hook you in. You know, you don't want to start with a really horrible
watch your episode one.
Watch it that. Watch your episode one, all that, yeah. And of course, with anthology, where it changes week upon week, it's really hard to. There isn't one that's representative. They're all completely tonally different. Some are horrible, and some of them are in this series are the darkest we've ever done, and some of them are very silly. So we've gone with ones that are very gettable early on, and then they become sort of worse.
When you work with the director on it, is it. Who's the director on this?
Well, the last series was all directed by Guillaume Morales, who's this Spanish director who did Julie's Eyes, this horror film. We saw it. We met him. We couldn't find the director. We had David Kerr, the first series, who was great, and we wanted him back, but he was busy doing No Offence, that Channel 4 thing, so we needed to get another director for the second series, and Guillaume came in for a meeting, and we just really liked him. So, and he'd never done a comedy.
Wow.
So we just thought he would sort of get it.
What's his English like?
It's good, yeah. You get it, yes, I think so. And he's great. He's doing really well.
And how do you approach with a director? Like, each story is different, but is there... Are you saying, but they have to look like they're from the same series? Is that ever...
I mean, that's a funny, good question. The tone of it, I think, because it is completely disparate, but and I sometimes think, well, what we're doing, so anybody could do it, but I think there is a...
I'm sure that's not true, by the way, but...
Yes, what I mean to say is we We are the tone of it, aren't we? Steve and I are in them, and we've written them. So I think that, weirdly, is its binding binding thing. And the thing that sort of is across them all is our sensibility, despite the fact that some of them are much more Pinteresque or Akeborn or farce or, you know, whatever they might be. And we didn't say to the directors, make them different. I think just anyway, in the way that the what the stories are, that that is its own thing, you know. That he had a great challenge on his hands when he had to film the one that was all set in a couchette in a train carriage. It was very claustrophobic. And then there's other ones where, in like the Sheridan Smith one, that was all through the house. So he was able to, he was great, Graham. He was very industrious and rigorous. One of the, I think the only director that I've worked with where I've thought, God, you've done a lot of work before turning up today. You know, you've storyboarded everything.
It's all about the prep.
Yeah, and it was like, I mean, it's almost too much. Like, it's like, and you do this, and you bend down here, and I thought, well, what might not want to do that? Yeah. You put a head on you. So you storyboarded everything to the, you know, and it looked beautiful. I think, but like Edgar Wright, you can tell it's a vision.
Yeah,
he's an artist, you know, and all those.
Well, that can sometimes be like two pluses hitting each other, because you're the creators of the show, but you obviously want the director to own it themselves as well.
Yeah, I think we go the other way once we're in and we're doing it, to let them feel that we're not there going, that's not what we want, you know, because easily you could pull that card and it'd be nightmarish.
Yeah, yeah.
But we've never done it. We've always gone, right, it's your thing now to create. Sometimes we've thought, I've run out and thought, can I just see that back? Because I'm not sure. Have you got the... Is it funny? Have we got the joke of it?
Yeah.
You know, sometimes where you think, that was meant to be a funny bit, but it's not quite being captured in a way.
Yeah, yeah.
And other times you can get that back edit.
Right.
But other times you think, I think we should just be further back off it so you can just see the whole thing rather than create it in an edit.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a comedy mind on it with Steve and I's. But our things are very, I think they're quite prescriptive. We write sort of the scripts like we imagine them landing.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, I had to spang that. Yeah. So they land in a way where you think, oh yeah, I think that's, the director will read it and think, and I think we paint the pictures that we imagine it will look like. I look back at a lot of our things and I think, yeah, that's just as we thought it would be, which is great.
Yeah, yeah.
Hit rate, I think.
Comedy-wise, how do you feel about the state of comedy?
I hate comedy. No interest.
Isn't it? Well, I detect an element of truth there.
Well, I don't like watching it because I get riled at anyone else doing it. I mean, I shouldn't, because I feel, like you say, we don't really do the same thing as anybody else. I always felt like League was in its own little cul-de-sac.
Mm-hmm.
They once tried to do, you know, that film, that thing, Comedy Connections, they used to be on.
Yeah, yeah.
They were going to do one on League of Gentlemen, and they started it, and they couldn't find any connections. It was like a cul-de-sac, Oxbow Lake. Wow.
You were all Lone Rangers.
Yeah, because we were not...
Maybe you're not real.
We were not liked, is what it was. I think we were just its own world.
Yeah.
We never did well on bills of other stand-ups, because we were our own little theatrical fourth wall. And you couldn't ever land with an audience, because, you know, Al Murray would come out and do his bit to the audience, and then we'd come out and we'd just talk to ourselves. And it's like, it never worked in that situation. You needed to be in our world for it to work.
Yeah,
so I think we never really did very well in that world. But
I wonder if they so would they be able to do a Who Do You Think You Are on any of you? Or are you all just none of you have a history whatsoever?
I think they did one on Mark went and found out he was a vampire or something like that. I can't remember.
It all makes sense. Do you don't really watch stuff. Love your honesty as well,
because
I find it, I think I'm better at it than I used to be, but I went through a few years where I just couldn't. There's also the occupational hazard thing of knowing the craft. I'm sure magicians or, you know, directors of all kinds do this. So you just see, you know, what's the tricks as a stand-up as well. It's I see that joke. Oh, that classic joke, the pullback reveal or whatever,
Oh, that's a good call.
It does make it a bit. But what about
some bolts of it? I mean, I try to watch it. I do watch some things, but I'm not, you know, I admire Bob Mortimer, who goes out and looks for the new funny people and puts them in his shows. You know, it's like, there's that adage, isn't it, that Kevin Spacey uses, that was given to him by Jack Lemmon, who said, send the elevator back down.
Yeah.
And I think, no, jam it.
Press the alarm immediately.
Yeah, put a chair in it and
could
stop
you do
people.
A Jack Lemmon impression? I've got this weird feeling you might be able to.
No, I don't think I can. I used to be obsessed with Glengarry Glen Ross.
Oh, man.
One of the best films in it.
That performance in that film from Jack Lemmon.
My daughter.
Yeah, is brilliant. Heartbreaking.
I know, yeah.
He's definitely one of my all-time favourites, I think.
Yeah, I think he is.
He's so good. If you can completely outshine Alec Baldwin, Al Pacino, Ed Harris.
Incredible performances like, across the board.
Just the amount of testosterone in that film.
Yeah, I know.
Have you seen the Louis C.K. new sitcom?
No, I haven't.
The one that he's released online?
Yeah, is that great?
Well, I've not seen tons of it, but you know, it's like... He has shot a sitcom in a multicam situation, but without an audience.
Right.
So it weirdly feels like a play.
Right.
But I was listening to an interview he did, and he said the inspiration was Abigail's Party.
Right.
Which I thought was...
Interesting.
And he didn't know it was... He saw it on YouTube and didn't know it was a play.
Right.
He was like, why have they done a sitcom without a laughter track kind of thing?
Oh,
and then found that out.
Yeah.
But... It kind of reminds me a bit of some of the stuff you're trying to do in that it's not comedy and a joke, traditional joke, sort of boom-tish.
Yes, yeah, no, not at all. Yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah, we've gone right away from that. I mean, it'd be interesting if we ever do any more League, because I feel it's a bit more rudimentary. That work was much more sketchy.
Yeah.
And
especially when you took it on stage as well.
Absolutely, yeah, God, that was, you had to sort of land with... Gag, gag, gag.
And you need a punchline on stage, don't
you?
Annoyingly.
I know, yeah. It's much harder.
Because the temptation to chuck in anything at the end of a mini story that's come to its natural conclusion and then you've got to end on some unsurprising...
Something that you can leave with, apparently it's worked, noise.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Do you... you love stage work as well.
I
saw you in the Alan Ackbourn?
Ackbourn, yeah.
I always want to say Ackbourn, but Ackbourn.
Yeah. Oh, did you?
Have some friends.
Yeah, I love doing that. Yeah, it was good fun.
I love that. I really, really enjoyed it. David Armand, who I've worked a lot with, he was in that. And
yes, yeah.
Was it Catherine Parkinson?
Yes.
And I love those kind of plays where it's all in real time.
Yeah. Well, it was funny because that play, as we're talking about the Abigail's Party, it predated Abigail's Party.
Did it?
Yeah, and it sort of is the Ackbourn version of Abigail's Party.
Yeah.
It literally is that setup in a way. And it was like 2 years
before. Has Mike been a naughty boy?
Well, some may say it. I'm not going to dare say it, but yes, possibly.
Well, no, it was really... You also were in The Producers, right?
I did that for...
That must have been a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was good, but it was...
Oh, not for a year, though.
Not for a year.
Nothing's good for a year, is it?
No, it was exhausting, yeah. I was sort of the fittest I've been, but the most decrepit, because I was...
Try having sex every night for a year.
Yeah, that's
that
what it's
still
like, yeah.
gets even that gets tiring.
I know, yeah, exhausting. So it was that. But yeah, I've done a lot of stage. I'm about to go back on stage with... I'm doing The Dresser, Ronald Harwood's play, with me as Norman. And
didn't they do a film version
recently,
of that quite recently?
Did,
yeah.
With Ian McKellen was Norman.
That's right. Yeah, yeah.
But I'm doing it with Ken Stott.
Oh, brilliant!
So that's in October. We start in the West End. Yeah.
And
so,
when are you? In October.
Yeah.
I missed you, annoyingly, but turns out the play was still amazing, in Hangman.
Oh, yeah, good.
I saw the version in the West End. I'm such a big fan of Martin
McDonagh.
So good. What was he like to work with?
He was great. I mean, he was there every day. It was weird, yeah. The director, Matthew Dunster, was... he made us do like circuit training every day. When he first emailed me saying, I don't know whether you know this about me, but I do circuit training every morning. I literally thought it was like a gag.
Yeah.
But he made it was, we did.
You were like, fuck off.
Yeah, what? Yeah. It's ridiculous. Yeah. But he did, and we did. And he and Martin was there every day, and he did it with us. You know, he was a proper team player. And every morning in the rehearsal studio in South London.
And what, did a personal trainer come in?
He did it, Matthew.
Oh, my God.
On stretches, and there was literally spots, and he would go around. It was an hour of it.
What was this? What is the... I mean, look, I'm all in favour of a bit of exercise, but what is the thinking behind that? Is it...
Well, it's sort of to get you warmed up and get you ready to do the acting. And, and weirdly, it did work. I thought by the end I understood it.
By the end, you were there crunching your six pack.
I loved it. And I
none of you look like the characters. You're all bodybuilders.
I know, yeah. None of
I couldn't
correct.
Tell. By the way, I couldn't tell watching the play that you'd all been doing intensive workouts.
Well, no, it wasn't for that reason.
Yeah. No, that's...
It was good.
I can totally see why that is. It's sort of... In a weird sort of way, I sometimes think about when you used to go to school and sing a hymn at the start of the day, which we hated as children.
Yeah.
But actually, wouldn't that be a great way to start
the day at
work?
It sort of gets you all into the same mind. Yeah,
and I you sort of lose your inhibitions in front of people.
And that's what it's about, I think.
Yeah. What do you... I know this is a bit of an annoying sort of question that you get asked all the time, but do you prefer stage or screen?
And my answer to this that I always give.
This is the 1,200.
No, but it happens to be true is that I do love both, and by the time I'm finished doing one, I feel like I am ready to do the other. So, having done a year of the producers on stage, I was craving the discipline of a little bit more precision.
And yet, nights off?
And a night off, yeah. Just to be in one night and just see the EastEnders music come on. Yeah. And then when I'm filming, I start to think, I wish I could just loosen it a bit and have the immediacy of the reaction, you know, rather than this will go away now and be recreated in an edit, you know, which is sometimes frustrating. But so I like doing both, and it's great to be able to flip between the two.
Before we talk about your guilty pleasure and other inspirations, just you've sort of touched upon it, and I suppose I have to ask, is there ever going to be a League of Gentlemen?
League of Gentlemen.
You've sort of implied.
We have met often in recent times.
In secret.
In
a bunker.
With pointy hats on. Yeah. And we spoke about doing something, yes, for the 20th anniversary. Depends when you think the 20th anniversary is. You could take it from when we first began, and it sort of already nearly is. Or if it's from TV, then that is 2019.
Yeah.
It'll be the 20th year since we're on.
So you've got 3 years.
So there's something in the... Yeah, we want to do something.
Yeah.
And we're going to set time aside to do it. It's just making us all free.
TV
but once
or
we say
stage?
We will do it, I think TV, but perhaps stage.
Oh.
Bit of both.
Okay. There's a slightly ambiguous answer.
No, it is. Well, we haven't really thought
or both
it.
At the same time.
Yeah.
Film
well,
and life.
Well, just two birds in one stone. Yeah.
So, your guilty pleasure. This is something... This actually blew my mind watching this. Before
Good.
We talk about it, what are the kinds of... I know that, you know, this is probably an easy guess that you are heavily influenced by horror and cult films and thrillers, but do you have, like, say, do you have, like, three films that you've... that are so that people can put this into context, they don't think that your guilty pleasure is some... reflects your real taste or anything.
Yes, of course, yeah.
Do you, what are like three of your
this
top?
This is an anomaly of the one I've picked, but I like my top three. I don't know, King of Comedy,
Good
Nero,
yeah.
probably Jaws, probably. We talked about that earlier. Theatre of Blood, Wicker Man, Don't Look Now, you know, some of the great horrors. Omen, I was obsessed with for years. Creepshow, you know, they are a lot of horror films, but not all the Python. Forays into film I love as well. The Airplane films, you know, just for their hit rate.
Yeah,
so I've
yeah.
got lots, I mean, a very eclectic
taste. That is a wide, yeah, yeah.
But this is a particular
favourite. Why don't you
favorite.
Tell us all what you've picked?
So I picked the 1990 film by Michael Winner called Bullseye, which some people will be groaning at that now and in delight, I hope.
Yeah.
But this was a film that Mark and... I think me and Mark, more than Steve as well, became quite obsessed with watching for a lot of the time on tour. And it's quite extraordinary. I mean, it's almost unwatchable. You said it is unwatchable.
I think it... Well, I didn't get to the end.
You didn't get
way.
To the end?
No.
Oh, God.
I'm sorry
it gets better
to say
and
that.
Better. It's... The premise is...
Do we have a clip, by the way?
Do you
we
have do, clips?
We have a clip. Let's just play this to
All
give
right.
people a sense of... This is the very beginning, I believe.
They say that everybody in the world has someone somewhere who looks like they do. It was my bad luck that the man who looked like me was an American scientist working on some scheme to produce cheap electricity by a thing called fusion. His name was Dr. Daniel Hickler. He was an idiot.
Now, that is literally the very first few seconds of the
That's
film.
That's what's hysterically funny about it. Not 3 seconds in, this exposition starts. That's to try to desperately explain this insane plot. And that doesn't stop till 2 seconds at the end credits. It's going on still. And then I got the money I was able to give. It's ludicrous. And it's terribly
What is
shot.
The plot? Can you describe
I
the
can't
plot?
Really. I don't really. I've watched it many times. I don't really understand it. It's like, I don't know. It's about two... Michael Caine and Roger Moore play these sort of lovable rogues, but they've got dual roles. They play these people that have created this fusion, these scientists.
Well, they've both got doppelgangers. What are the chances?
It's like, I know, exactly. Sort of like, what's that Shakespeare that got two sets of twins? It's that, but done by Michael Winner.
And, which is a film that's how the pitch went. That
As You Like It, is it? No, not As You Like It. Oh God, find out which one it was. But anyway, yes, it is a terrible film, and it's badly edited. It's not even very well made. It's every joke falls flat. I mean, the astonishing thing about it is how poorly made it is. It is literally there are cuts in it. The edit is so loose sometimes. Michael Caine sort of is in full mid shot, and then he goes to open the door, and then it cuts the other side of him, and he's doing the same action again. It's so ropily
like
edited,
double open. Yeah, yeah.
Terrible.
There was a bit where there was a single shot of him, and he sees a bus off camera, and he does some of the worst seeing a bus acting, and then we cut to a bus that was obviously shot like the next day
or
something.
To the Scotland bit where there's all that footage of footage of the Highlands of Scotland.
Yeah, loads of stock footage. Yeah, yeah. But what's surprised me about this is a lot of people's guilty pleasures are films that maybe are they're just a bit kind of too mainstream, or they're just they're really cult, they're actually good but people don't really know about them, or this is a strong contender for technically the worst film.
I mean,
I'd see why it's a guilty pleasure, because there is a lot of fun to be had
there
watching these people.
I would absolutely recommend it. I mean, it's jaw-dropping.
I don't know what's worse, Michael Caine's American accent,
oh my God,
or Michael Caine's Michael Caine accent, which is also really weird.
It is astonishing.
And in a film with so much bad editing, set pieces, design, you know, music, it's weird that the prosthetic nose is actually quite good.
I know, it's like the only good thing in it. But yeah, he has some terrible lines.
And Roger Moore seemed trying to do a slightly less posh accent as his gangster character.
That's right, yeah, of course.
So that there's you can tell who's him and the doppelganger.
But there's great bits where they've got the doppelgangers together, so there obviously is two sets of... There's doubles with bad Michael Caine wigs on, and they have fights together, and it's just astonishingly edited.
I kept thinking when I was watching it, because it sort of reminded me of the look of and feel of it, of A Fish Called Wanda.
Right,
and it sort of made me think...
You mean, especially the music as well, that kind of 80s kind of
drive.
You know,
80s London crime caper.
Yeah, it's that's a terrible disservice to A Fish Called Wanda.
It is, which is a brilliant film.
Yeah.
It felt like Michael Winner went, I can do that.
Yeah,
and they just decided to do it. Weirdly, it's two of the names on the screenplay credit are Lawrence Marks and who's the
Gran?
What's his first?
Morris Gran.
Morris Gran.
And
they've written great stuff, so I don't know what happened.
I think it's the execution of it, because there's a running gag at the end when they're being chased and through this sort of. They go to the Highlands of Scotland to secure this deal for the fusion. Secret. It's just absolutely terrible. And there's a continual bit where Caine gets hit by sticks and swords and things, and it's just it's a misfire every time. Terrible.
There isn't
film.
A single. Yeah.
No, it's awful. There's a brilliant bit at the end where they're both on. They chase after their counterparts. They dive on a motorbike. It's two elderly men, and it's there's these shots where you can just. It's clearly on a dolly. Going about 2 miles an hour, really carefully, with them sat up placed on it, and then trying to cut it to make it look like it's exciting, and they're going fast. It's just a joy from beginning to end, in a terrible way.
When I watch this, I actually get scared, and I'll tell you why. Because I think, this is Michael Caine, Roger Moore, whatever you think of them, they are, you know, legends in their own right. They've made good films.
Yeah.
Michael Winner, he's made, I mean, Death Wish is quite a good film, isn't it?
Yeah, I know.
It can go that wrong. And I direct a bit, and I always think, what if I get it that wrong?
Yeah, you do a bullseye.
Yeah, I pull a bullseye.
I know. Well, that's the fear, isn't it? You must not.
How could it not? How could all those people working on it? I mean,
it's so cheaply filmed, and it's dirty looking. It's sort of it looks like a confessions film. It feels very...
Yeah. No, confessions are they're actually quite well made, I think.
Right, in comparison, right, okay.
It's a really good choice, Rhys.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think you might.
I thought you would know it. I'm glad you haven't introduced you to it.
There's actually a couple I've not known, maybe
that's
like
great.
Two.
I'm glad it's.
I mean, the thing about Caine's oeuvre, let's say, is that 80s to mid 90s where he did shitloads of films.
Terrible films, yeah.
And there's like three or four in there that if he had just done those, his career would have been impeccable. I think I've got a list here somewhere. Like in that period from 80 to 95, before he did Blood and Wine with Jack Nicholson.
Yeah.
He did something like 35 films.
Wow.
And I can
Was Jaws in the middle of that lot?
Jaws 4 was there.
Yeah, of course. But
the ones that are good, genuinely brilliant films, are Hannah and Her Sisters.
Yeah.
Mona Lisa, I like.
Yeah, he's great.
Dirty Rotten Scoundrels.
Yeah, he's funny in that.
He's brilliant
really
in that.
Good, yeah.
And Educating Rita.
Brilliant, yeah.
I think, and the Muppet Christmas Carol, which you can't.
Well, that's one of those ones, and a little bit like this, where if he doesn't have to be there, it's not him.
Yeah.
You just watch that again, and it's like any back shot, it's just not
body
him.
Body double, really?
Yeah, a lot of body double, yeah. He's physically can't get away with it being there. But he obviously wasn't there on the day.
That's amazing. That's only about 6 out of 35.
That's not bad.
And Steve Oram, as you know, he was in before and he picked The Hand. And it's making me think you could probably do a series of Guilty Pleasures just on Michael Caine films.
I bet you could. I'm sure he should be the first to say it, yeah. But isn't it funny, that terrible accent, and then he wins the Oscar for Side of House Rules, doing the same voice.
It's weird. And when he's good, I love him so much.
Absolutely, yeah.
But he clearly... Did you think he's someone that just needs a director? Don't know. That's
don't
a weird
know,
thing
yes.
to say,
Who
isn't
knows?
It?
Yes, that
he
be,
is a legend. He's
is,
done really well.
Yeah.
Why am I saying whether he needs a director or not?
He knows what he wants. But that was maybe a friend. The very final shot, which you haven't seen because you're not seeing the end, is John Cleese turns up in it.
To try and save?
No, he's on the beach at the end. You've got to watch it. It's just ridiculous.
I'm going to watch the end of it because it is enjoyable. So that is Bullseye.
Yeah.
Please check it out. So, Reese, thank you so much for coming on. It's been
You're
an
welcome.
Absolute pleasure chatting to you. Good luck with the play and
you,
the third
yes.
series of Inside Number 9.
Thank you very much.
The last song you have picked, do you want to explain what this?
Well, this is from, I think, 1977? I can't remember. It's All That Jazz, which is the film. And it's the last song in All That Jazz. And All That Jazz is about this sort of... It's sort of based on the life of Bob Fosse. He directed it. And in the film, he's played by Roy Scheider, who's sort of being Bob Fosse. And it's just a horrible decline of a man in sort of the death throes. Bob Fosse had a heart attack, and he wrote it about death and facing death. And there's a great... It's a very black comedy in the way that there was a spate of those in the 70s. You know, those great, gritty 70s films like American... The Raging Bull and... French Connection, and it's in that vein. It's very brilliantly edited. There's a finale in sort of as he's in his death throes, having a heart attack, where he's got a big song and dance number, and it's to the Everly Brothers' Bye Bye Love, but they sing Bye Bye Life.
Yeah, it's amazing. I'm really good to see Roy Scheider doing something
or singing or dancing.
Yeah. Thank you very much. What a great choice.
Thank you.
Goodbye. Bye-bye, your life. Goodbye. 2, 3.
6.
He's gonna die. I think he's gonna die. I think I'm gonna die. I sure am blue.
He sure is blue.
I sure am blue.
He sure is blue.
I sure am blue.